I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is Open Source with the scholar of Black Power, Peniel Joseph of Tufts University, who has finally written the big life story of Stokely Carmichael, who's still mesmerizing, the Quicksilver activist, theorist, street hero, preacher, and prophet of Black Revolution in America and the world. Also with us, the grand historian of the Black migration in America, from the Jim Crow South, North, South, East, and West to the forefront of the culture and the national conversation, Isabel Wilkerson. She was the last big-time journalist to sit for a long talk with the man in 1998, 30 years after his heyday, when he called himself Kwame Ture and lived mostly in West Africa and was months away from death from cancer. With us, too, Jamal Crawford, a Boston disciple and heir of Stokely Carmichael's thinking and activism, a Pan-African movement man looking for a new movement. Join the conversation on Stokely Carmichael at 800-423-8255. But first, the sound of Stokely Carmichael, edgy and still smooth, defiant, witty, confrontational, some said menacing.
No man can give anybody his freedom. A man is born free. You may enslave a man after he is born free. And that is, in fact, what this country does. It enslaves black people after they're born. So that the only act that white people can do is to stop denying black people their freedom. That is, they must stop denying
against
freedom.
Us.
We've taken all the myths of this country and we found them to be nothing but downright lies. This country told us that if we worked hard, we would succeed. And if that were true, we would own this country lock, stock, and barrel.
Peniel Joseph, welcome. That, of course, was Stokely Carmichael from the electric Black Power speech to 14,000 people on the UC Berkeley campus in October 1966. High tide of civil rights and Vietnam protest between the assassinations of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr., a time when Stokely Carmichael, age 25, looked to a lot of people like the future, a black nationalist messiah, maybe, according to J. Edgar Hoover at the FBI. And Hoover was said to block that prospect. Remind us how that young man got so hot in his mid-20s, where he was coming from, where he was going.
Well, Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture, was born in Port of Spain, Trinidad, June 29, 1941. And he comes to the United States 2 weeks before his 11th birthday in 1952. His family settles in the Morris Park section of the Bronx. And it's really a predominantly Italian, predominantly white neighborhood that he lives in. He goes to Bronx Science. And at Bronx Science, he's really one of the best students there, extremely charismatic. It's a predominantly white high school, predominantly Jewish. But there's also another side that's forging him and forming him intellectually, and that's really Harlem. That's really the African-American, the Caribbean, the Pan-African tradition. He's reading voraciously. He's reading black history. He's also reading from a black social democratic tradition, and he's influenced by Bayard Rustin, the black social democratic activist from New York City. By 1960, he goes to Howard University, and the sit-in movement further politicizes him. Stokely Carmichael was an organizer as a teenager. He was organizing garment workers. He was organizing folks in Harlem. He starts to become an organizer at Howard University. He joins SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which is the civil rights organization that comes up after the sit-in movement. When we think about Stokely between 60 and 64, he is a student, but he's also an activist. He's going to Mississippi every summer. He's a freedom rider. And when we think about him as a freedom rider, he's arrested for the first time June 8th, 1961. So he becomes this sort of protean figure even before the call for black power. He's this organizer for radical democracy, militant nonviolence, and he becomes one of the most sought after young charismatic leaders within the movement.
Get him to Lowndes County, Mississippi, in the Freedom Summer of 1964. In your book, you can feel a man finding his vocation. Somebody said, and it's not just sentiment, I don't think, that he fell in love with black American poor farm people. Take us to that moment.
No, he loved poor black people. When we think about Stokely in Mississippi, sharecroppers. He lives with sharecroppers in Mississippi and Alabama. Lounge County is Lounge County, Alabama. Mississippi.
I beg your pardon.
No problem. He's Mississippi. He's in the Delta. He starts visiting Mississippi in the summer of 1961. By 1962, he's with Bob Moses in Mississippi. Yep. He's organizing folks in Greenwood. He becomes the second congressional district director for Freedom Summer, the Summer Project, interracial organizing in Mississippi. He lives in Mississippi after that, but he's disappointed by the Democratic National Convention and the fact that Fannie Lou Hamer, Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, and grassroots activists try to get seated at the Democratic National Convention in August of 1964, and they're rejected by the President of the United States, right? So the Democrats really were anti-democratic, and he says he's going to organize independent, autonomous politics, and he organizes that in Lowndes County, Alabama. Black sharecroppers, there's a local movement. There's SNCC activists who went down there with him, including Judy Richardson, who's a local activist, Bob Mance. And what they do there is they hook up with a local movement led by John Hewlett, and they formed the Lowndes County Freedom Organization. The nickname for that party is going to be the Black Panther Party. Mm-hmm. And they're going to use that symbol because so many people in Lowndes were not formally educated. They were not formally literate. Doesn't mean they were not intelligent. They were actually hugely intelligent, but not formally educated. And that Panther symbol allows them a context to see and to vote. So they organize that independent politics. And by 1966, that Panther symbol is going to reverberate all the way around the country to Oakland, California, and Huey Newton and Bobby Seale.
But in the Delta already, you can see the profile, the self-image taking shape. He's fixed on power, but he's detached from the politics of respectability, as they say. He's urgent. He's angry. At the same time, he's sort of insouciant. Reminds me a little bit of Muhammad Ali. I mean, he's sort of Cornel West's wildest dream to be a kind of energetic everywhere, intellectual, inspirational man. Do I have it roughly right?
Well, I mean, he's a revolutionary. When we think about Stokely Carmichael Kwame Ture, who is he? He's a political revolutionary. He's a social activist, but he's one who's really inspired by a deep love of poor black people. One thing to mention is his friendship with Martin Luther King Jr. They find common ground in a love for black culture, not just black expressive culture, but black folk culture, black music, but poor black people. Carmichael has a great interview with Studs Terkel in Chicago in 1965, where he makes the argument that Fannie Lou Hamer, the sharecropper from Ruleville, Mississippi, who's an organizer for SNCC, is as important to the United States as Martin Luther King Jr. And he says in some ways she's more important because there's actually more Fannie Lou Hamers out there than Martin Luther King Jr.
Martin Luther King had a dream. Stokely Carmichael, who, by the way, did not make it to the march in Washington. We're not sure just where he was
that day.
Did he have a dream?
He absolutely did. I mean, it's a dream that starts off as a dream for radical democracy, ending Jim Crow segregation, and it's going to evolve into a dream of revolutionary anti-imperialism, anti-capitalism, basically pan-Africanism, racial justice, economic justice all over the world. Third World Revolution becomes the dream.
The launch of Stokely Carmichael's Black Power slogan, you write, I love this phrase, it transformed the aesthetics of the freedom struggle. Power ahead of talk, power ahead of the asking, which is a burden he hung on Dr. King, power ahead of justice, power ahead of freedom, even brotherhood. Could we listen again to the Black Power speech, another section from 1966, and then I want you to decode that phrase.
This country knows what power is, knows it very well, and it knows what black power is because it's deprived black people of it for 400 years. So it knows what black power is. But the question of why do white people in this country associate black power with violence? And the question is because of their own inability to deal with blackness. If we had said Negro power, nobody would get scared. Everybody would support it. If we said power for colored people, everybody would be for that. But it is the word black. It is the word black that bothers people in this country, and that's their problem, not mine. Their problem.
You know, it strikes me that the sum of that, those parts is bigger than, the whole is bigger than any of the parts. Nina Simone, wonderful line in your book, Peniel. Nina Simone of the famous Mississippi Goddamn song said about Stokely's speech, that speech, I've been thinking some of the things I heard tonight since I was 3 years old. Do you know what she meant?
Yeah, absolutely. When Carmichael's calling for black power, and again, on that Mississippi march, SNCC activists are calling for black power. Willie Ricks is calling for black power. They're saying not freedom now, but black power. Stokely is saying radical social, political, economic self-determination, including black people being able to identify themselves, their history, their wants, their needs for themselves. But he also, by talking about black power, does something remarkable. He identifies white privilege and white supremacy as well. So that's really important. By talking about black power and making an argument that black power is actually universal, he has a big debate with Bayard Rustin in 1966, where Bayard says black power is too narrow, and Stokely says, no, black power is universal. It's just universal in black. And Bayard, you can't get your head around that. You can't wrap your head that something that's black could also be universal. So when we think about it transforming the aesthetics of the black freedom movement, what it does is really provide a context for radical political self-determination that's going to impact foreign policy. It's going to impact everything from African-American and African and Caribbean culture. We think about a black arts movement. The late Amiri Baraka just passed away, who becomes an avatar of that movement. Yeah. Sonia Sanchez, many others. It's also going to impact politics in terms of black elected officials, community organizing, tenants' rights organizations, welfare rights organizations, the movement for black studies and black student unions and community control, self-defense, the Black Panthers, free breakfast. So this is really panoramic.
You know, you're spelling out Nina Simone's mind, and I think it's important, and she was not alone. Power is complex, obviously. He was talking about self-determination and expression and the self-interest of poor people and communities under their own people-first control. Black America today, interestingly, comes up short on income, education, ownership, all the things he was talking about. At the same time, black power extends to Hollywood, to big-time sports, every kind of entertainment, into the White House, as Stokely could barely have imagined when he chose that phrase. Isabel Wilkerson, on a phone line from Atlanta, wrote the magnificent account of the migration that changed the way this country feels and looks to itself and the world. The book was called The Warmth of Other Suns, about 10 million black people moving over 50 years out of the Deep South to New York and Boston, Chicago and Motown, Los Angeles, Seattle, all of it between World War I and the 1960s. It's one of the books I'd take to a desert island, Ms. Wilkerson, if I could only bring 10 for all time. And on top of that, you wrote a long and fascinating portrait of Stokely Carmichael, renamed Kwame Ture, age 57, back in 1998. He was sick with cancer back in Florida after 30 years from his new home in West Africa, and it turned out he was close to death. When you called him on the phone, you write, he answered, ready for a revolution, in one word.
Yes, he was at the late stages of his life, and one couldn't have known it at the time. He was obviously a towering presence in 20th century America, and seeing him at that point, you know, being in his presence, I was aware that this was an incredible human being.
Yeah.
The time he was witty and he was warm. He had actually a soft voice that kind of belied the power of his words, and he had an easy laugh. Mm. He looked really fit and well. I mean, he had this magnificent glow to him, which you can see in the original picture, the pictures of him when he was younger. He really had a baby face to him and this wonderful smile that just went, you know, just sort of would light up the entire room. But there was a sadness and a sweetness to him at the same time, and he was vigilant and still working to his last breath for what he hoped would be freedom for his people.
Isabel, in that Essence article, which I love, you wrote, you said to him, you realize that the reason 34 million people call themselves black is because of the man sitting serenely in front of you, that before he got the nerve to shout black power to a civil rights crowd in a Mississippi square in the belly of Klan country in 1966, we were neither black nor beautiful, but Negroes, or worse. What did he say?
Well, he was a very humble human being. I mean, he didn't seem to accept his celebrity very, very readily. He saw himself as part of the people. And one of the things that I was struck by the way he spoke was that he spoke in the plural. There was a part of the time that I spent with him, and I should preface it by saying that he was ill, and he was seeking care in the West after having moved to Guinea, where he spent most of his life after he left the United States. And he'd returned to Miami, where his mother was in a condo. Hmm. And so together they were there talking about his life and what it had meant and who he was. And he seemed to have deep within him this connection to his people that transcends what most leaders would have. So he spoke in the plural. So he said at one point, when I was asking him about his work and his life and what it stood for, and he said that he didn't have any money. He'd never taken any money. He'd never made any money. His mother laughed because she had hoped he would be a doctor. That was her dream when the family sent him to Howard University. Right. He was their only son. And at a certain point he said, "We don't speak for money." When it came to all the things that he'd been doing after he left the country and he returned to the United States, and the only way he could get his message across was to give public talks, and he said, "We don't speak for money." All of the money that he'd raised went back to the movement, went back to SNCC, went back to whichever organization he had believed in at the time. And they all laughed at that because the mother had hoped that he would be so much more than what he had become. And in fact, she came to accept, and he came to accept that this was who he was.
Isabel, I wonder if you wondered, why did he seem so scary to so many people?
You know, it's such a great question because he was so unassuming and so disarming in person, just quite charming and quick to laugh and easy to smile and so warm. It actually would take some time to adjust to being around him because he was so different from what you might expect. And I think that it was the power of his words that might have been.
Had he changed, Peniel? Do you think? I mean, or was that fierceness kind of act?
No, I think the fierceness was still there, always there, and it's just part of a multifaceted personality. So he was always usually charismatic. He's usually sensitive. He's funny, quick-witted, but he could also be very strident. He could give you the fire and brimstone, the rhetorical critique against the United States. You know, we are all African people. Ready for revolution, but also a strident criticism against American capitalism and inequality, war, and imperialism.
I would agree with that completely. I would say that the time that I spent with him, which was an amazing couple of days, you know, it's still hard to believe for me now, I got the sense that, you know, there was no agenda within this man except for the salvation of his people. He seemed almost incapable of being able to present anything other than how he saw it, truly how he saw it. There was a sense of candor and forthrightness and truly being up front with what he believed and really truly at peace with it. He didn't hold back his words. You're absolutely right. There was no sense of artifice with him. You felt that you were in the presence of a truly pure soul.
Isabel, I want you to put him in the context of the transformative migrants that you wrote about in The Warmth of Other Suns. I mean, the migrants out of Jim Crow, which he was not, but the Toni Morrisons, the Bill Russells, the Chuck Berrys that changed this country.
Well, he was part of a parallel migration that was occurring at the same time as the great migration of African Americans out of the South to the North and the West, and his parents arrived to the United States and then sent for him, and him arriving in the early 1950s. So he was arriving right during the wave of this great migration, two of them essentially coming from the South and from the Caribbean to the big cities of the North. And when he spent time both in the Bronx and in Harlem, he would have been surrounded by people who were part of this great migration. When he went to Howard, he would have been joining classes, attending classes with people who were also part of it. So it was these were children, first generation in a new world, with the expectations that life would be better and perhaps would be more fruitful and fulfilling for them than it had been for their parents who had made these great sacrifices to leave all that they had known to come there.
What does it tell us, Isabel, that Stokely Carmichael left the United States eventually for a sort of global identity? I mean, there were others like him, including, you know, Marcus Garvey was a traveler too. W.E.B. Du Bois, I was just going to say, from Great Barrington, Massachusetts to Ghana by the end. C.L.R. Right. James from Trinidad ended up in this country. He was deported, ended up in England. What is that? How do we understand that?
My sense is that he, I can't speak for the others, but that he, in the time that I spent with him, really truly identified with the cause that he believed in, truly was living it, and truly wanted to be among the people, meaning the source of the people, meaning Africa itself. I think that he had grown disillusioned with some of the after effects of the movement that he had worked so hard in. In other words, the success of it, meaning people being able to move into positions of power. He was one of the people who, he would say, blacks in position is not the same as black people in power. Mm. And so he felt that in some ways his goals had been shaped into something different, which would have been his goal of seeing the inner strength of people, having people recognize their own inner identity and not necessarily looking at the physical world, the physical manifestation of success as it might be defined. And so I think that he was fleeing all of that.
Peniel Joseph.
Well, I think she's exactly right, but I also think that we have to think about the FBI, the counterintelligence program by J. Edgar Hoover.
Right.
Massively, he's going to be under surveillance between really around 1964 to the rest of his life. So they're trying to try him for sedition. They're trying to charge him with treason. They set up snitch jackets against Kwame Ture and Stokely Carmichael, saying that he is a CIA agent, that he's making millions of dollars, that he's working for the federal government. Mm-hmm. And that's an attempt to have him assassinated. So part of leaving the United States is that if he had stayed in the United States, he certainly, I think, would have been murdered. And he would have been.
I was going to say, was he ushered out? Was he told, you better get out of here?
No, he wasn't told, but certainly the FBI and the illegal surveillance, the illegal unconstitutional surveillance. So the FBI has waged a war, and it's not just the FBI, it was U.S. intelligence. Lyndon Johnson had twice weekly reports on Stokely Carmichael. So our national security agencies, our local police bureaus, State Department, United States information agencies, when he's going overseas, they all have him under surveillance illegally. Hoover says he could be part of the triumvirate. That's a black messiah. Stokely, Dr. King, and Elijah Muhammad, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. So when we think about why he left, certainly he knows that Richard Nixon has just been elected president. Things are going to get worse. And really, the year, you know, when he leaves the United States by 69, people like Fred Hampton are murdered, Fred Hampton and Mark Clark. There's so many different, Black Panthers and Black revolutionaries who are going to be incarcerated and victims of state violence that, you know, there's a regime of racial terror in the United States, and he's definitely escaping that regime, even as he wants to go to Africa and wants to use that as this Pan-African headquarters for revolution. His life is under threat, imminent threat and danger in the United States.
You know, I read this history, Peniel, with some embarrassment, but I was there in those days, and I'm wondering what was it that spooked, shall we say, white folk about this guy who could be rude. He certainly was a truth teller in your face, no bones about it. But why the panic? Why J. Edgar Hoover? Why two reports a week to the president of the United States?
Well, I mean, he was speaking truth to power, and he was a revolutionary. I mean, the fear was that the kind of politics that he was espousing would infect the black community. The fear was that what Stokely Carmichael was talking about with black power would turn people on and away from violence, away from any kind of negative behavior, into political and community organizing, and create a community that was so single-minded with so much black consciousness in a positive way that they were going to upend institutions in American society and really be part of a revolutionary force. And it wasn't going to be a
revolution. Could it have happened?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that it wasn't going to be a revolution with guns and tanks, right? It was going to be a revolutionary consciousness that really transformed so-called ghettos into urban oases that were political, that were social, cultural. And we see some of that worked when we think about Newark, New Jersey, and Amiri Baraka, when we see the organizing that Stokely did in Lowndes County and other places. Some parts of the country did indeed get transformed, but so many were left behind, and that's because so many revolutionaries were hunted and hounded and at times incarcerated and even killed.
I'm thinking of the...
Considered, I completely sorry, agree. I think well. It might be considered frightening to have one's entire sense of one's place in the world and the entire essentially caste system that was in place to have it upended and threatened by the words of someone who was as charismatic and as convincing and as popular, in fact, as he was.
I'm thinking of a Massachusetts Senate campaign in 1966. Ed Brook, pale Republican black man, first black in the Senate since Reconstruction and all that. And he had a marvelous line. He said, "A vote for me is a vote against Stokely Carmichael." And he won big time.
He won big. And many politicians scapegoated Stokely Carmichael. Many white politicians and even black ones like Edward Brook scapegoated Stokely Carmichael.
Yes.
There was a whole fear
he
of
was
Stokely
a lightning rod.
And what he represented. And really, the fear of Stokely was that Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture, loved to expose American lies, right? He loved to expose the gap between democratic rhetoric and democratic reality. He loved to expose the lies of working hard and making it in the American dream when he knew from the work he did in Mississippi, from the work his father did as a carpenter and taxi cab driver, the work his mother did, the work he saw poor black people do, that the whole notion of Horatio Alger and bootstrap ideology was a lie. It wasn't true. He had experienced that. So exposing that in the context of the 1960s and civil rights and black power became an existential threat, especially to power brokers within the American government, J. Edgar Hoover, Lyndon Johnson, many other people who were connected to national security agencies.
We're hearing the Stokely Carmichael story that we didn't quite get the first time around with Peniel Joseph and Isabel Wilkerson on the line. Our phone's 800-423-8255. Mukasa Dada is on the line, also known as Willie Ricks, a close friend and comrade of Stokely, if I'm not wrong. Mukasa.
Yes, you're right, brother. How are you?
I'm good. I read in Peniel's book that you were in on the invention of that slogan, debating it for, against, what does it mean, etc. What does it connote, denote? What were you thinking?
Well, we was under extreme crisis as a people and as a movement, and that when we were being beaten down and our workers were being lynched and killed and murdered inside the SNCC, and we were living under apartheid throughout the South, we just said that we need power for black people. We need black power, and that we need to stand strong and be able to defend ourselves and fight back. And we need an identity. So when we said black power, we just meant power for black people, and it later defined itself.
Mukasa Dada, what are you doing for an encore in 2014, and what might Stokely be doing?
Organizing and trying to unite Africa, because he saw that Africa would be our real black power. United States of Africa would be our real black power. He felt that the only way black people throughout the world going to have a home or have real power is have a liberated, unified Africa.
But what are you doing? That's a big continent, a lot of people. What are you doing day to day?
Organizing and working to unite Africa and working to get our people to identify with Africa, because at this point, our people, especially the United States, have no identity. And one of the things that colonialism and imperialism has done to us is divide us up into 1,000 different little pieces in Africa and outside of Africa, and we're trying to bring those pieces together where we would have black power. Because at this point, we are suffering and more hungry and starving and dying probably faster than anybody else on this earth.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Peniel Joseph.
No, I agree. I think that when we think about what's happened in the 50 years since the Black Power Call, it's technically 48 years, things for African Americans have gotten, for the majority of them, have gotten worse. So if you think of Black Power as sort of Barack Obama or Oprah Winfrey, that's really connected more to what Kwame Ture would say, black capitalism, right? When we think about black power as social political revolution and transformation, where public schools are providing decent education, where black people have decent homes, where there isn't such a thing as mass incarceration and a war on drugs against poor black and brown men and women, right? That would be real black power.
Isabel, I wonder, does that sell short the cultural power that you and I have talked about before. I mean, from Motown to 12 Years a Slave to every kind of pulse in this country that has a black feel about it.
Well, I mean, clearly there is a great deal of creativity and genius that can come forth out of the repression of a people, and that is what we're looking at when we see the contributions, the art and the music and the theater and the artistry, just the creativity and brilliance that comes through in the things that you mentioned. I think that what he was speaking about was finding the spirit, soul, power from within, self-actualization and inner strength as a people. I think that he wanted to erase the false divisions of tribe and nationality, and for people of African descent all over the world to see themselves as one people and not to fall into the labeling that can occur with the change in geography.
Isabel Wilkerson, we're talking about Black Power this hour with the Stokely Carmichael biographer Peniel Joseph and the historian Isabel Wilkerson. We're taking the measure of Black Power today in and out of Hollywood and the White House. 800-423-8255 is our phone. Here is Stokely Carmichael from the 60s again, talking about the road ahead.
We're not going to win this struggle today. We're not going to win it tomorrow. We're fighting a struggle that has been taking place for 500 years and even way beyond that. And all these generations have struggled and waged fierce struggles. I mean, anytime people get real smart and say, we're not going anywhere, I say, hey, man, think about your grandfather. He was a slave. Mm-hmm. White boy was whooping him every day. Now look where you are. See how we're moving.
Jamal Crawford, in our Boston studio, is known in rap world as Uno the Prophet. His sound is undeniably Nubian, he says, and outspoken.
1 million Taino, 1 million Arawak, 10 million more of our people who ain't coming back. 10 million of our people with scars on their back. Cracker, tell me that it don't matter, but matter of fact, I'm the surprise in the box, I will crack a jack. After that ain't nothing else to do but to holler black. 1 million kids who ain't got no options, either they down with the goons or the goblins.
Jamal, take a bow.
Jamal Crawford. Thought I'd hear that on NPR.
Jamal ran for the Boston City Council. He presides over a small and spirited network online at blackstonian.com. Stokely Carmichael spoke of how we're moving, where we're moving. Where are you moving in 2014?
Well, really trying to, you know, still accomplish some of the goals that were espoused at that time. And, you know, some of the points that you brought up earlier, it strikes me as how so much time has elapsed, but how many things have kind of remained the same. So when we're talking about, you know, what made Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture so scary? Well, it's the same thing now, isn't it? You know, what makes Farrakhan scary? What makes Dr. Khalid Muhammad scary? Any black man who was expressive in that manner and eloquent and fearless and speaking out against power has been scary. And the concept of black power, I think, is still quite scary. It hasn't, you know, subsided since the 60s or whatnot. I know that when during my tenure with the New Black Panther Party, that was, you know, one of our slogans and mottos, black power. And just the saying of that phrase to this day is still sends chills up the power structure's spine. And I think that power in the term of black power is only scary to those who would deny you that power.
When you speak of black power, Jamal, you talk about the seen and the unseen, both locally and nationally, maybe universally. What does that mean?
Well, there's two movements. You know, as Dr. Joseph said, you know, when you're talking about people like, you know, the Oprah Winfreys or the Bill Cosbys or what have you, you know, you're talking about black capitalism. But I think a lot of people, that isn't what in their mind is black power. It's more in line with black achievement. And most of those achievements are individual and related to careers and oftentimes money and success, whatever that means. But there's another undercurrent of black power, the thousands of people across the country who are working day in and day out, who are volunteering at shelters and working with disenfranchised youth and poor people and working in their communities, you know, against violence and drugs and crime. And these are the people who don't have household names or there is no fanfare. There are no articles and interviews and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And I think there's this undercurrent of people who are, you know, doing their own farming. They're joining their own collectives in their own neighborhoods. They're doing homeschooling, noting that, you know, the public educational system is not going to educate our children in the way that we see fit. So I think there's a lot of movements towards independence that are working right now and unfortunately don't get the shine and the attention. But once again, to those who would deny that power, it is against their nature, and it is not for their benefit to highlight those things. So I think that, you know, the Black Power movement of the 60s and the 70s, one thing that it did after J. Edgar Hoover and the like had did this full frontal assault on the leadership there through COINTELPRO, that the next measure that they did was weapons of mass distraction. They pumped in the drugs, you know, and then the next generations, you know, now we have, you know, MTV, we have PlayStations, we have Nintendo, all these wonderful things to keep our mind off of things that are more important.
Mm. Speak about Boston as a talented 10th sort of place, a place that trains the world's minds, including Barack and Michelle Obama among the millions. What does that have to do with your comfort, your experience of Black Power?
You know, the philosophy of the talented 10th, I think, is, you know, in short, that the most talented of this race, this 10%, would come back and contribute to the rest of the 90%.
W.E.B. Du Bois phrases, I remember.
Right. But I think what we've seen is that 10%, who ends up doing quite well for themselves, begins to disassociate themselves from the base that they came from. And it hasn't really panned out that those people have exactly bent over backwards to come back and use their new skills and their new wealth in many cases to benefit the people in the communities that they came from. So if we once again, you know, hate to pick on them, but if we use once again the Oprahs and the Bill Cosbys, the Michael Jordans of the world, we don't see, and they're doing some great things, but we don't see their undying commitment to solving some of the social ills, at least not in a meaningful way that I think comforts Black people across the country.
Jamal, speak, and I'd invite Peniel and Isabel to join in. About a book by Michelle Alexander called "The New Jim Crow," it haunts the consciousness in a way that the whole notion that, for example, in incarceration, especially, but in poverty, in drug prosecutions, etc., we are reenacting a kind of segregation, undoing Black Power even as we speak.
It's not a kind of segregation. I mean, it's clear. The 13th Amendment has spelled it out and said that, you know, slavery is abolished in America, except, you know, and I think that people need to really make that connection. And I think she did so masterfully in her book. But to make that connection that, you know, incarceration kind of just replaced and became the new modern slick version of slavery and the vestiges of Jim Crow. And now what we have is an entire population that has been targeted, and not only targeted by incarceration, but when we look at the cases of police brutality around the country and, you know, the other instances, the Trayvon Martins, the Jordan Davises, and so on and so forth, we see that, at least for us, it's been clear to us that Black people are still under attack in this country. And when you look at what the government did to quash the Panthers, the Black Liberation Army, many of these people who are still currently incarcerated, even though we recognize the COINTELPRO acted illegally, but yet their cases still are sticking, Mumia's and Matulu's and so on and so forth, Imam Jamil, who's formerly H-Rap Brown, that when we look at what that attack did to the quote-unquote Black Power movement and the civil rights movement, but then we see that the Ku Klux Klan, neo-Nazis, Aryan Nation, and Brotherhood, they're all doing quite swimmingly and have not dealt with that same type of governmental oppression.
I'm thinking also of David Simon.
What's interesting is that when I spoke with what he was called then, Kwame Ture, in 1998, he anticipated the mass incarceration that we see today. Mm. He said, the quote is, "It's to be expected. The system is going to do everything possible to suppress us," he said. "But those prisons are going to turn out Malcolm X en masse," he said.
Well, I think one of the things is the new Jim Crow metaphor right now in 2014 can be extended beyond mass incarceration. And the folks here have spoken eloquently about that. I think 50 years after the passage of the Civil Rights Act and Freedom Summer, the huge contradiction of American society and American democracy, and certainly Kwame Ture Stokely pointed this out, is that we actually have Jim Crow in every single facet of American life, right? So we have it in terms of housing, we have it in terms of healthcare, we have it in terms of racial disparities, where African Americans are overrepresented in negative racial disparities and underrepresented in positive social economic disparities, right? Employment, racial achievement gaps. And but here's the difference between 50 years ago and now. There's two big differences. One, 50 years ago, black people all over the United States and really the world over, you think about the anti-colonial struggle, they knew they were being oppressed. So even though there were class differences within the African-American community, ideological differences, there was one overarching goal in terms of to stop Jim Crow, stop racial apartheid that Mukasa Dada was talking about earlier. 50 years later, there's a couple of things. Certainly there's the elite that Jamal was talking about. And I think that's complicated because I think elites, black elites can't be expected to somehow defeat capitalism all by themselves. This is a system and structural problem that we're dealing with, even though we can say they need to do more. But so many young people, the millennials, the people on the iPhones, they're 20 and under, they don't know about racial oppression or racial history. They're experiencing it, but they don't have the consciousness about it, right? And the other is the when we think about white America, we had a more honest conversation about race 50 years ago than we do now. There's no acknowledgement of racial oppression. And in fact, when you do the polling, and social psychologists do this, white people feel they're the victims of reverse racism. So we are in absolutely surreal times right now, right? So it's insanity, except for black people are catching hell in terms of the lowest rung of the economic ladder, unemployed, no unemployment benefits, in segregated Bantustans all across the United States, and no one's doing anything about it.
I'm still thinking of David Simon, the Wired producer, saying the other day about Baltimore today that the one thriving industry in that city, in black Baltimore, is the drug trade.
Is the drug trade.
And making tons of money, employing lots of people. But for 50% of the black male population of Baltimore, there will never be a productive job for the rest of their lives. And sort of the message is get used to it. Hard to square this, again, if Stokely were back on Earth, with the fact that we have a black president or a black man in the White House. How do we put those things together?
Well, I think that one of the things he would say is that Stokely, Kwame Ture, in terms of the contradictions of American capitalism, the contradictions of American imperialism, in the sense that 50 years ago, 40 years ago, you could not have a black man or woman as head, even the titular symbolic face of this country, of this nation state. 50 years later, you can, but what are the reverberations of that for the black community, especially for poor black people? And are those reverberations enough? So you're not blaming Obama for unemployment, blaming him, but you're saying, is a black president or a black face in a higher place enough to help poverty?
And it creates a situation also, Jamal, too, where even someone such as the president, leader of the free world, has to distance himself from anything that even remotely smells like. I mean, can you imagine if he had even uttered the phrase black power during his campaign? It would have just completely tanked him. And I think now there's been so much discussion like, you know, he cannot be seen as the black president. So even when you're at the pinnacle, you have to still kind of hide and couch your affinity towards things that are black.
Yes.
Jamal, forgive me, Isabel, go ahead.
He had a great skepticism for politicians, actually. He described African-Americans who were in positions of mayors were playing in what he called a ballpark of electoral politics. I think that he really put his faith and his belief in the inner strength of the people themselves. He had this connection to and spoke to the lowliest people and sought to lift up those lowliest people rather than looking to people who might have ascended to positions but not ascended to what he called power.
Jamal, I'm wondering what you hear from kids, and including the hip-hop world, both the commercial music on the radio and elsewhere, but from the sensibility that you see every day.
It's actually quite alarming. And I think that most recently in the news, people might have seen this cover by a popular female rapper, Nicki Minaj, where she used a semblance of a Malcolm X image and whatnot. And I think really that for most of them, it's not even really a thought. And I think that most of it is just fodder. As Lil Wayne did and said, you know, I beat things up like Emmett Till or what have you. Just fodder for some sort of catchy phrase that they're using. I don't think that there's any serious thought into it. If there were, I think it would have a major impact on the minds of the youth. And the artists who are doing that and pushing that type of thought, you know, the Mos Defs are now Yazeen Bey, the Dead Prezes, the Talib Kweli's, in R&B, even the Erykah Badu's. I think that movement for consciousness and music, I think, is an important one. And I think really that's where the future is, because what we're being force-fed right now, I don't think that there's any longevity in it.
What is the appetite in young Black America for Stokely's message? The kind of appetite that Nina Simone was speaking about. That's what I've been thinking since I was 3 years old.
I think there's a huge appetite. And I think part of the reason, and I worked on this book for 10 years. I mean, part of the reason why I worked on this book was to try to reintroduce and recover Stokely, Kwame Ture to a whole new generation. And this is not in any way to disrespect or ignore all these millions of folks who know who he is, but there's really tens of millions of Black people who don't know who he is, right? So we lost, we kept Malcolm, we kept Martin King's legacy alive, but Kwame Ture's legacy in a national way, not among certainly Pan-Africanists and revolutionaries and Black activists, they know who he is. But in terms of young people, they don't know who he is. And I'm not talking about just young white people. I'm talking about Black people. So part of this is if they can be reintroduced to Stokely and what he meant.
Outside outside hard covers. I mean, maybe on YouTube.
Yeah, no, part of it is using social media. Part of it is doing any form, whether it's, you know, documentary, whether it's speaking at bookstores that are outside the confines. I'm speaking at Revolution Books tomorrow. I mean, when we think about this, this is about, like, you know, speaking to audiences of folks who are outside of ebony and ivory towers. And there's so many young people who come up to me after talks and parents who are like, you know, can you come to Roxbury? Can you come to Dorchester? And I do, where you give free talks and your activism becomes trying to spread this knowledge to so many people who are not going to go to Tufts University or Harvard or any kind of university, but want that knowledge.
What would the magic words be today, do you think? I mean, what are those people waiting to hear?
Well, I think they're hungry for affirmation beyond the conventional outlines of mainstream normative American success. Right now, we live in a world where I think Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture is a great example of a life well lived. It's not just Barack Obama and Michelle Obama, although I give them props, you know, Harvard Law, beautiful family, but that's not the only success we can have as Black people in the country. It doesn't mean you're a hedge fund banker or Oprah or LeBron James. You can live a great, grand, beautiful, rich life of political struggle.
I love rediscovering Stokely Carmichael in your book, Peniel Joseph. And for me, it satisfies a hunger for truth tellers, reckless people who say things as he did, like, I don't want any part of a country that's napalming peasants in Southeast Asia. I'm out of here. We need revolutionaries, as Thomas Jefferson said a long, long time ago. Thank you, Peniel Joseph, for this book, for this conversation. Thank you, Isabel Wilkerson, again and again and again. Thank you, Jamal Crawford. Last word goes to the musician Archie Shepp and his tune, Le Matin des Noirs. One night in late December 1966, Stokely Carmichael left the stage of the Village Theater with Archie Shepp playing this music. Stokely said, I really dig this music. It's my kind of Christmas music. There's a lot more at radioopensource.org. You can help us with next week's show, too. This show was produced by the radio revolutionaries Kunal Jasti, Max Larkin, and the engineer George Hicks. Ryan Catalani helps out. Mary McGrath is our executive radical. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source.